So while we're talking about war, let's get into the part of your book that looks at hard rock, or you know, this rise of heavy metal that Black Sabbath, this iconic band, was responsible for, and the way in which what they were hearing, these stories about Americans fighting in Vietnam, inspired members of Black Sabbath to ultimately record one of the best songs against the military-industrial complex ever recorded, War Pigs.
Well, that's a really almost comical story. I mean, war is tragic, obviously. But the way that they stumbled onto writing War Pigs, they had played a gig in Switzerland, and they were interacting with a lot of American military who were based there. And they were telling pretty harrowing stories of what was going on in Vietnam. So all of a sudden, a heavy metal band that's obsessed with the occult and dark imagery is starting to gain a political consciousness. But the actual lyrics and name for War Pigs came out of something that might have been in the mockumentary Spinal Tap, because they wanted to call the song Walpurgis, you know, which is, you know, this holiday, this pagan holiday. And of course, their label said, no, we're not going to have any suggestion of the occult or Satanism or paganism or anything like that. We're not calling it Walpurgis. And I believe it was Tommy Iommi, the guitarist, who said, oh, well, why don't we just call it War Pigs? Sounds like Walpurgis, War Pigs. Yeah, yeah, let's do that. So then the song ensued. But all that aside, Black Sabbath did something that hadn't been done before, and surprisingly wasn't done very often after. And that was taking a musical genre that is perfect for protest, heavy metal, and basic sound of the songs, the anger, the sometimes horrifying imagery in heavy metal, and connecting it to war. What could be more natural? And yet a lot of heavy metal musicians and composers just, they would come up with anything but political consciousness. They'd come up with cannibalism and Satanism and being burned alive and what have you. And because War Pigs was really the first metal song that was political, it set a certain standard, and I know that a lot of people have called it the most important heavy metal song ever recorded.
Let's move on to Gil Scott-Heron and talk about you know, your inclusion of him in the examples of musics. I think he's definitely one of the more underrated musicians when you look at the way that music has such a power. The way he could express social political ideas were always clear, and they really cut right to the heart of what needed to be said. And you know, the song that really stuck out to me, again, I'm listening to a lot of this music. Everybody who who considers these artists now and what they mean and how they protest, they have their context in which they were recorded. And Gil's responding to Nixon, Gil's responding to Reagan. But now, you know, you go back, you listen to it, and I couldn't help but when Trump was inaugurated, I was connecting all the themes and everything he was talking about. The B-movie, having this actor that was being elected to run the United States, was now, I mean, it's a little worse. We actually have like a C-list actor, a D-list actor who's running. So right. I guess it's a D-movie. But you look at the lyrics for that song, and they're all incredibly appropriate for our moment. But then the other songs, it's very rare for a musician to sing so clearly and pointedly about the threat of nuclear war as well as environmental destruction. You don't have a lot of those kinds of songs out there from artists.
Yeah, and Johannesburg, which was one of the most powerful indictments of apartheid in South Africa, course, most people remember, if they know Gil Scott-Heron's work, they think of The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. And you make a really good point, Kevin, that even though he's talking about the 70s and his cultural and political references are from that period, you can take Nixon and Spiro Agnew, as he mispronounced him, and John Mitchell, and just plug in Trump and Giuliani and Lev Parnas and Devin Nunes, and the list of, you know, horrific people goes on and on. So it's a time capsule, but it also suggests that there's a continuum of corruption that we have to be responsible for battling. And it's also funny. It's outrageously funny. You know, Bullwinkle the Moose and Julia, which was the, you know, Diane Carroll is the first black female running character on network television. And he also showed that, he also showed that you could do really beautiful soulful music. He did a piece called Pieces of a Man, which is a stunning R&B number, very soft and very mournful. And the character who is speaking the lyrics is remembering his father coming apart after he loses his job. And the song ends with the character who's speaking the lyrics hearing a siren wailing and knowing that it's something his father has done illegal in order to support his family. And it's very elegiac and just stunning piece. And it summarizes what happens when you have institutional poverty of any color of people in a society. You force them into crime because they have no other options. So, you know, he not only could write the overtly political, he could write in other ways that were more subtle and more lasting. And, you know, he used Brian Jackson to create background of jazz or soul or blues or whatever. And part of his lasting legacy, I would say, Kevin, is that he inspired all musical artists, but especially black artists, to use poetry. I wish it was obviously used more in hip hop, but we got to a point where we had poetry slams. And you go to a poetry slam and you watch those young people, they are basically carrying the mantle of what Gil Scott-Heron did with his words way back in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, the first album that he recorded that became popular was an entirely spoken word album that had just like bongos, basically, right, in the background for the most part.
Percussion.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, and it's not that he was the very first person to do this. There were guys in Harlem and there were guys here in Watts in Los Angeles who were experimenting with that form and really in-your-face kind of street language and simple musical accompaniment. And that was the beginning of it. And Gil got excited and he raised it to a beautiful poetic art form.
Right, like The Last Poets, for an example.
Last Poets and the Harlem, the Watts Prophets. That's, I think, the name of the band out here in Los Angeles. And sadly, you know, he came to an end because he was addicted to crack cocaine. And there's an amazing New Yorker profile of him where the guy who was interviewing him couldn't get him out of the house. He would spend all day in the house in his apartment in Harlem. And the guy writing the profile said, "Hey, let's go get some lunch." And in his typically, you know, sly way, Gil Scott-Heron said, "Oh, I don't know, man. I hear sunshine isn't good for you." You know, even to the end, he had this amazing perspective. And especially for people who want to write songs that that can be subtle or can be overtly political, I think they should look to his work.
And he did get an opportunity to make some music in the final years of his life. The 2010s, I think one of the top albums of the 2010s was the album he recorded, which has New York Is Killing Me on it and Me and the Devil, and those were really rich songs. And he also would talk about, he got back out and did some concert performances. It was the only time that I got a chance to actually see him perform, being as young as I am. So I was pleased to be able to catch his later performance. And he'd talk about his work getting the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. He went out there with Stevie Wonder to make that happen.
Yeah. Now, that's an amazing little timeline, too, Kevin, because it actually starts with James Brown. James Brown is at sort of the peak of his renown with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and he's created an anthem for his people, and he wants to create a national holiday for Martin Luther King, and he goes to Richard Nixon and meets with him. Nixon only meets with him because he thinks, wow, if I am photographed with James Brown, I'm going to siphon off some of the black vote. He had absolutely no intention and played James Brown. But then you have Stevie Wonder creating a tour, and Gil Scott-Heron's on it. And it marshals enough of a momentum where they finally create a Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, which we just recently had. You know, I love stories like that because, Kevin, a lot of times I bump into people who go, yeah, it's important to create socially conscious music, but, you know, in the end, it just makes you feel good. It doesn't change anything. That's absolutely dead wrong. It's dead wrong in the case of Stevie Wonder helping create Martin Luther King Jr.'s holiday. It's wrong in the case of P.F. Sloan, who wrote Eve of Destruction, and had lyrics like, you're old enough to kill, but not for voting, that led to an amendment to the Constitution so that 18-year-olds could get the vote. Peter Gabriel changed history when he wrote Biko, about Stephen Biko, the anti-apartheid leader who was murdered in his cell in Port Elizabeth, South Africa. And then Biko started a movement where college students, Kevin, not Democrats, not NGOs, not organizations, but college students started going to the administration of their individual colleges and saying, we note that you've invested money in South Africa. We want you to divest, or we're going to protest every single day. And most people have forgotten about this. The divestment movement that started with Peter Gabriel's Biko in 1980, by the end of the decade, billions, with a B, billions of dollars had been pulled out of South Africa by the U.S. government. And it was all generated by protests from college students. So the next time somebody says, oh, a song can't change anything, you say, you don't know what you're talking about.
And to segue into the last example I wanted to cover with you, although I have a couple additional questions I'd like to squeeze in here, but the last one I wanted to highlight connects to this, and it's Public Enemy's song, By the Time I Get to Arizona. And as you write in your book, you talk about the state of Arizona voted by a margin of 17,000 votes in 1990 not to make Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a national holiday, as stipulated by federal law. So then Public Enemy recorded this song with lyrics that were directed at Governor Evan Meckham, who, after his election in 1986, canceled the mandated celebration and said, quote, and you say clumsily, but he said, I guess King did a lot for the colored people, but I don't think he deserves a national holiday. So talk about their foray, Public Enemy, this seminal rap group into this, and then also the video was controversial. MTV didn't want to air it, right?
Right. Well, Evan Meacham was not only years behind the time in recognizing, along with the other 48 states, New Hampshire was holding out, that an MLK Jr. holiday was overdue. He was using the term colored people. Hello,
Right.
Smell the plutonium, pal. Where have you been?
You know, I felt really uncomfortable reading that quote, so just to add that.
Well, we know that you were reading a quote, Kevin, so... But, you know, Chuck D and the gang at Public Enemy created a video where they show Evan Meacham getting into a limo and then it blows up. And, of course, they were under fire, you know, for, quote unquote, advocating violence against an elected official. But my favorite response was the old Arsenio Hall show where he asked Chuck D, well, what would Martin Luther King think about your advocating violence against Governor Meacham? And Chuck D came back. He said, no, I don't think that he'd be very happy about it. To start with, he wouldn't be very happy about being shot. And the audience just erupted in applause. So, you know, there's more confrontational quality in hip-hop music today. Which, again, I wish that we saw more of in all forms of music, and especially in metal, as I mentioned.
And I did want to give you an opportunity to just address, because I like that you raise the example of 9-1-1 as a joke in your discussion of Public Enemy. And you do quote Denise Sullivan, this journalist and author of Keep on Pushing Black Power Music from Blues to Hip Hop. And, you know, this whole thing of what makes it such a great protest song, because it's one of the first to articulate this reality of how the police don't respond to the emergencies of people of color.
Yeah, and it came from Flavor Flav being on the street and... There's a disagreement and a friend of his gets stabbed and they call 911. And instead of being there within minutes, they're there like 25 minutes later and the guy's dead. So there's a direct living response that connects to the reason for writing that song. And, you know, John Oliver on HBO, he has a terrific show, very amusing and very important show, I think. And just a few years ago, like 4 years ago, I believe, he had a segment about 911, dialing 911. And he said that there are hundreds of thousands of calls that are accidentally made, that the infrastructure does not exist to respond properly to all the true emergency calls. Even today, we still haven't figured out a way to do that. And I think... he made some crack about even Domino's can figure out how to deliver a horrible pizza to you, and we still can't do 911 right.
So it's been really great talking to you, Brad. I appreciated the book. And for people who have been listening to our conversation, once again, I want to tell you that the title of the book is Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. And I think you could probably find it wherever most books are sold. It's probably available through Amazon, but you could also do the old go to your library, request it, ask them to purchase a copy and see if you can get it that way. It's always nice to make sure the collections of your local library have books like this. So once again, thanks for talking.
Yeah, I really appreciate the conversation and your knowledge about political history, which makes this interview a lot different from people who just listen to music. And there are 15 photos, by the way, in the book, five in color. So Rutgers University Press did me a favor by doing that. Normally it's the responsibility of the author. And I welcome anybody to find me online at brashcyber.com, B-R-A-S-H. CYBER.com. And I really appreciate your time, Kevin. Thank you so much.